Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Pride Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 52 of Nerd Pride Radio. 52, 2 times 2 times 13. It's a standard French deck of playing cards, number of full weeks in a year, number of white keys on a piano, and of course, DC's new 52 launch in 2011. But most awesomely, in the year 52, Roman law made it illegal to execute your slaves just for being too old or too crippled. Wow, how magnanimous of them. Wasn't that awesome? So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome! My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd, plus there's probably like 7 other kinds of nerd I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my brain anymore. And my co-host this week, El Grappidoro, the Stapler. All right, we're going to get straight to the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. This is the time for me when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list. Then the best stuff off of that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. So, first thing on the master list,
And now for something completely different.
Thank you, John. I was struggling. This is something completely different. This is just stuff I don't have a category for yet. And on my notes, it says a pee incident. Yeah, I was sitting in my office. This just happened yesterday. And you ever had this? I'm sitting in the office, and I'm thinking to myself, all right, I need to get up and go pee. It's time. I really have to go. But the minute I'm ready to get up, someone comes into my office, Becky. God bless her. Very nice. I like Becky. But she came in, and she's got some questions. And I'm like, all right, I can wait. A couple questions. No big deal. Well, half an hour later, she's still there, and we're still talking. And it's an interesting conversation. I'm giving her some advice about a computer thing that she's got going on and all this. But, you know, it's a half hour later. I had to pee 30 minutes ago. But I'm like, yeah, conversation's got to be over any moment. We'll just wait this sucker out, right? Right? All right, now we're up to 45 minutes, 50 minutes. And finally, I realized that, you know what? We're just having a good time talking. We could be here all day. I'm like, I am so sorry. I have got to go. You know what? I had to pee when you first got here, and I can't take any more. But, you know, if you still have questions, I'll be back in just a couple minutes, really. All right. So, you know, she laughs about it, and I go running off to the bathroom. And this was the thing. I have never peed that long in my entire life. All right, and you say, Mike, that's disgusting. Why would you even bring this to the podcast? Because I have to tell somebody. I mean, all right, I'm in there, and I'm in the last stall on the end because the first two stalls were occupied. There were dudes in there clearly sitting down from the way their shoes were facing, and they were in there the whole time. I mean, like, I got in, I finally did all my business, got washed my hands, left, all right, and they were still in their stalls. So I assume they're sitting down for whatever they're doing, reading the newspaper, playing video games, whatever they do in there. And as I'm going, I mean, I didn't time it or anything. I wish I had. I wish I had thought that, oh, this is going to – I should really get my watch out if I owned a watch. All right. But I didn't time it. Ben, I'm really bad about estimations like this. But I would guess it was probably a solid 9.5 minutes. Oh, my God. It was forever. Just one of those – just you know, like Austin Powers in the morning at the – start of the first movie when he's unfrozen and he's there forever and the joke just never ends. It was exactly like that. And it was the kind of thing that here's these two other guys. I know they can hear me. They're right there. And I don't even know. And they've also got to be guys that I know and know pretty well because there's only so many of us down this hallway. I just had this urge, and I should have. I just had this urge to shout out in the middle, go, do you guys hear this? Do you hear that? This is a record. This is a world record. What? Oh, man. But I didn't say that, and I have no idea who was in there, so I can't even confirm with them. There's like no witnesses to my glory. That's what I'm saying. I think this is a guy thing. Any of my female listeners, are you guys ever that proud of your waste elimination processes? Because, I mean, you know, all this says is that I held it way too long, and apparently I've built up a very large bladder capacity. That's all it says about me. But for some reason, I was a little proud of that. It's the kind of thing that, like I say, I wish there'd been a stopwatch in there. All right, some sort of race clock in there that's telling me, boom, go. And then when I got all done, they'd go, oh my God, 5 minutes? Call Guinness, it is a record. We're ready. Kind of thing that, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get this gross about it, but, I've had discussions with numerous people, Yancey's one of them, that you ever had one of those moments where you go in and you wish you had a before and after wait when you go to the bathroom? That you're like, you get up and you're like, South Park did a whole episode on this. Like, oh my God, that has got to be a world record. That has got to be. Oh man, if only I had weighed myself before going in here, and then, you know, if there was a scale at work so I could weigh myself, then I would know. But alas, there's no such thing for us. We thought, wouldn't it be nice to just have a toilet that just did that for you? And I'm sure somewhere out there are toilets that do that. I'm sure there's some fancy Japanese toilet that washes your hands for you afterwards too, makes you some eggs, whatever. And then the process will also tell you, oh, by the way, you eliminated 4.5 pounds today. Aren't you proud? Pretty cool, right? Yeah. But tis not to be for me. So anyway, that was really disgusting. I should probably, you know what? I think I'm just going to edit this whole section out. I don't even, this is a little gross, a little over the line, isn't it? Yeah. You know what? Let's move on to something even more different. Where is it? Oh!
Oh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science!
And that music means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. This is my science corner. And I told you last week that the science topic I had that I was putting off till this week, and this is what I'm going to do now, is throwing cats out of windows for science. Oh, I just recently heard an article, and it was a podcast. TodayIFoundOut.com is the website, and they have a daily knowledge podcast. And one of their podcasts I was listening to was talking about the survival rate of cats falling from high places. And this is not something new. I've read a very similar thing a couple of years ago. But apparently, cats survive really well. On average, when being dropped from high places, that the whole cats always land on their feet thing. There's some basis in truth about this, that, the interesting part of it is that the higher up they fall from, the less injuries they get. That's not exactly true. It's that, okay, really low falls, really low injuries. All right. But then there's a spike at like, you know, 3 or 4 floors up is where your maximum injuries are going to be. And then above that, the injuries kind of drop off up to like 5 floors, 6 floors. And once you're beyond like 6 or 7 floors, then they've already reached terminal velocity. It doesn't matter how high you go. Cat can't fall any faster than that. So therefore, you drop them from the 42nd floor of a building, which they've got records of cats that have fallen from that high, 30 floors up, 40 floors up, that have been brought into the vet and survive. And it's amazing. And again, like I say, highest death rate seems to be at like the 4 or 5 floors mark. And then above that, it drops off. And so the question is, oh, all right, why? And this was the interesting part to me. All right. The other part is something, like I say, I've known that for a long time, that cats survive really well at high places, that there's this odd spike in the graph. But then it got to trying to figure out why the survivability rate works the way it does for cats. And I realized how complicated a study this is. That basically the information we have to work on is mostly people who have brought their cats in after their cats have fallen from high places. And so, therefore, the only records we have are veterinarians who are looking at the survivability rate, the injury rate and survivability rate of cats who have been brought in, who have fallen from whatever height their owners report. And there's so many factors that play into it because, okay, maybe it's that, you know, above a certain height, cats have enough time to properly orient themselves and brace for the impact. Or potentially, someone said, well, cats who have fallen only a short distance are panicked by falling and they tense up and that causes more injury. But when they're falling from higher places than that, they actually fall far enough that they're like, okay, done tensing up. I guess I'm not hitting ground. And they kind of loosen up. They relax. They get that kind of drunk effect where you just sort of absorb the impact, kind of roll with it a little bit. But also confounded by the fact that these are all cats who have fallen from really high buildings, which means all of them are landing on cement, which means, you know, if we wanted to do a real measure of this, we'd have to be throwing some cats out of windows to land on, you know, grass or dirt or something else, other materials if you want to get some real comparison. Or possibly, there's just so many possibilities. And unfortunately, and or maybe the difference in rates is due to the fact that, you know what, after they fall from certain high spots, some of the cats are just going to be plain old dead. And a lot of the cats who are just plain dead don't get brought in at all. So how are we going to measure the cats that died on impact and we never even saw them? So for all we know, maybe most cats who fall from 25, 30 stories up, maybe 90% of them die, and all we have is the measure of the cats that are actually brought in. And they kind of compare that a little bit by saying, okay, but if you look at the overall injury rate, the number of injuries sustained for each cat, for all the cats that are brought in, the ones who fall from higher places have less total injury, like less things broken, less. So it's just an interesting measure. And so as I was trying to put together, if morality wasn't an issue, how would you construct a study for this? And the whole idea of constructing a study that involves throwing cats out of windows, and then, you know, you're going to have some control cats that we throw out of windows, and we're going to have some, I don't even know what all the factors that go into it are, but it just fascinated me. I was just completely caught up in the science of this. I think it's absolutely wonderful. Again, this is another one of my stories. No real point to it, but just fascinating that they have this much data about cats falling out of windows and yet nothing that you can control, so nothing that they can say anything definitive about. They just got a bunch of wild guesses. They just know that this is what they see when they come into the doctor. Weird.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
Oh my god, is it time for my gaming table already? Role-playing games, video games, card games. If it fits on my gaming table, then I am here to share it with you. All right, this one's going to be tough. I went through the first two really quickly, and I've got one more after this that hopefully we'll have time for, and I'll probably go through that one a little quickly too. Because this one I think is going to take some time. It's the kind of thing that I've been babbling to myself about this in the car whenever I drive. I turn off the podcasts, I stop listening to the radio, and I just take some me time to just talk this one out. Because I'm having a tough time with it. I have had, this is a Pathfinder topic, ostensibly, but I have had on my master list for a long time the topic, the nature of Pathfinder evil. All right, that's what was written down. And that kind of ties into what I'm going into here. It all sort of comes together. I was online, and there is a blog that I ran across. Well, first off, the reason I was doing a search in the first place is, as you know, in our Rune Lords campaign for Pathfinder, I run a half-orc bard and a girl, female half-orc bard, young, ugly but charming. This is my character. And I wanted a new image for her. I wanted a new character portrait for her. So I'm doing some searches for half-orc females online. Or orc females in general, and it's really hard. Have you done this? Have you tried? Have you paid any attention to the depiction of orc women on the internet in gaming of all stripes? Because there's lots of World of Warcraft stuff, there's lots of D&D stuff, Pathfinder stuff, there's orcs from a bunch of different sources. You get lots of Tolkien orcs in there. And the majority of female orcs that are depicted come in two types. Either it is a standard muscle-bound male orc picture, but with some breasts grafted on and probably longish hair in a ponytail. That's, you know, typically just to, that's what makes her feminine, is her pigtails. Or it's either, like I say, either a male orc that is vaguely feminized, or it's just a hot chick painted green. I mean, well, except they have pointed ears. So a lot of times what you're looking at is this is a portrait that if the skin weren't green, you would just assume it was an elf because she's really good looking. All right. And she's got the standard outfit and the weapons and the whole bit. There seems to be almost no middle ground for female orcs, that either they're built to be super hot fantasy chicks, which is not, in general, not the role that orcs play. That's just not, they're intended to be homely by human standards. That's just the way they're designed. And so the ones that do make them homely then wind up making them these gross, overly muscled, and even sometimes the overly muscled ones, I mean, really, it's just, you know, some Red Sonja looking character who winds up being muscled up, huge cleavage, huge standard fantasy artwork cleavage with the dangerous metal armor with that giant spear point dimple in between her boobs that will kill her if she ever gets hit there. And the only real difference then is she has a set of tusks or a slightly piggy nose or it's grotesque. It's really hard. And so, I finally found a picture that I kind of like. It's actually a half-orc blacksmith female. She's not overly sexualized. I just took a face shot of her and she's got her hair up in these braids that I thought were kind of cool. And so it's a good picture. I like it for my character. I'm going to use it for a while. See how it goes from there. My previous portrait was just a little too cutesy. It wasn't overly sexualized, but it made her look vaguely cute. I was trying to emphasize the bard aspect. I needed someone playing an instrument. And in doing so, I got someone who just wasn't quite orcish enough. So, anyway, in my search for this picture, as I'm going through all these different shots, I ran across one picture that came from a blog called A Swarm of Feminist Bees. And A Swarm of Feminist Bees, the article title, and this is what caught my eye, the article that went along with the photo I was looking at, was racism in orc depictions, or racism and orcs, from Tolkien to Pathfinder. That was the title of the article, or at least roughly. And it was really long and really dense. And I've read the article like three times through now, and it was just fascinating. I'm going to try and do it justice here. And I think my explanation of what this article's point was, I think is going to come across a little too simplistic. And a lot of you are going to dismiss the points that this woman is making out of hand. But I think that's a mistake. This is one where I'm actually going to make a real effort to go in and put a link to this article because I think it's worth reading, even if you don't agree with her. And I don't agree with much of what she says, but even if you don't agree with her, there is a valuable viewpoint to be absorbing here. And what she's saying is she starts off with an examination of how orcs are presented in Tolkien, and then examines how that has evolved through Dungeons & Dragons 1st edition, all the way up through Dungeons & Dragons 3rd edition, and then into Pathfinder, and this evolution of orcs in general, and how they are presented to the gaming public. I guess Tolkien wasn't gaming, you know what I mean. And in Tolkien, it's very obviously just blatantly racist overtones that these are dark-skinned savages, they're uncivilized, they're brutal, they're very much the depictions of uncivilized races and societies in the real world from that day and earlier. And the orcs come across as grotesque, and they are, as Tolkien intended, but they're depicted as just these brutish monsters who are inherently evil. They were created to be evil. Therefore, they are inherently evil. And she makes the connection between this and racism and the idea that, you know, people said the same thing about non-white races once upon a time, is that they were created, that they were lesser beings, that they were, there was something inherently inferior about them. And a lot of those traits and language that was used, in even, you know, quite civilized society 100 years ago was the exact same language and overtones that are being used by Tolkien to describe his orcs. Okay. I grant her point. And so then she goes into, early D&D orcs, almost the exact same thing. All right. And then it evolves slightly and you see this evolution. But even in Pathfinder, she's saying that, okay, Pathfinder has kind of brought this up a little bit. But even still, you're still getting this same sort of language, the same sort of this inherently inferior, inherently brutal. And so her point is, even if orcs, as depicted in Pathfinder and modern D&D, even if they're not racist per se against any particular real life race, she's saying that there's a problem with their depiction in that the language and descriptions being used still reinforce the language and thinking of racial discrimination. All right. Now, this is the part where I'm going to lose a lot of you, and I get that. But the idea is not that it is racist necessarily against any person, but that it promotes a way of thinking that feeds into racism, that it's keyed into that mindset. And again, I don't know that I completely agree with all that, but there's a very valuable point to be made in there. I'm one who believes that the language we choose to use makes a big difference in the way we think about stuff, and the fact that our modern society is so grossly racist and sexist and homophobic in a lot of ways, and a lot of other discriminatory ism terms that I'm not going to list off, but those are the three that come to mind right away, that it is just ingrained into our culture, the whole idea of, you know, as we grew up, the idea of telling someone that they throw like a girl or do anything like a girl. The fact that it's like a girl is insulting. All right? And that's not even, wouldn't even necessarily have thought of it as sexist growing up. It's just, that's just a term you use. Or even referring to someone as an insult, calling someone a sissy. Or 10 years ago, I always thought it was really funny to, you know, when someone's being a little squeamish about something or they didn't do quite as well as they should have or whatever, you respond with something like, oh, what's the matter? You got sand in your vagina? All right. To imply that, oh yeah, well, to be a woman would be to be inferior. To be female, to be not male is just inherently inferior. That's just the nature of the insult. And, boy, that's wrong. That's really wrong. And I've worked really hard and I'm not perfect about it. You guys have listened to me for how many hours on this podcast? You know, I'm not perfect about stuff. But I try and fix that up. I try and be better about it. I try and be an ally to people who are fighting the good fight. I am clearly, middle-aged white male. I'm not in any of these oppressed groups, but I try and be, on the right side of stuff here. And so, all right, hold on. Give me just a second. I'm going to pause for just a moment because I've got this sheet of notes in front of me. And I just normally if I take notes on something, normally I put it right here in the show notes. I get everything all lined up. This one, no, my thoughts are so scattered. I have this little piece of paper. It's actually a Far Side cartoon from an old calendar. And on the back of it, there's a to-do list from work that all the stuff is crossed off on. Thank God. But then around the margins and across it, I've just kind of scribbled all these words. I just kept it in my pocket. And every time I thought of something new on this topic, I just sort of scribbled stuff down. But now I've gotten far enough into this that I need to reorganize for just a second. So hold on. Oh, I'm glad I paused. See, that was the point I started with. I started off with the nature of Pathfinder evil. because one of the things that there was, in addition to this article being just fascinating on its own, she wrote this back in October, I think, so it's only about 6 months old. There is an ongoing discussion underneath it that she still has had new stuff and new responses from her just in the last couple of weeks. So this is really ongoing. And one of the things that comes up a lot is that one of the biggest problems with these depictions of orcs and other races, I mean, they brought up goblins and other stuff, but one of the big problems with how the races are depicted is this idea of inherent evil. That, you know, when it started off in D&D, early D&D, you guys remember the days when if you saw an orc, you could just go kill it. Because, well, it's evil. You know it's evil. I mean, yeah, we could go up and have a discussion with it, sure. But in general, it's an orc, so it's evil. You just kill it. It's easy. Nice, simple, bad guy. You don't have to think about anything. You just go kill him. And there's lots of animals, creatures, monsters, intelligent beings within D&D that are like that. The dragons, as Rich Berlewin says in Order of the Stick, conveniently color-coded for your convenience, that the dragons, you know, if you see a black dragon, red dragon, white dragon, whatever they are, well, you know that those are the evil ones. It's okay to go kill those. If you see a metallic dragon, okay, those are the good ones. All right, good. Easy to sort out. We know what we're dealing with here. And people pointed out that a lot of the problems people have with what they're labeling as racist in these games is a lot of times a problem with the idea of inherent evil. The idea of just describing a race as just being inherently evil, and there's something wrong with that. And to a degree, I agree. I'm right there with you. For example, in my games, kobolds have not been evil for a long time. Kobolds are one that I see them as they're oppressed. They're often enslaved. They're oppressed. So as a result, they become culturally xenophobic, and can be a little bit mean, can be cruel to outsiders because they've always been bullied, because they've always been in this position, but they're not inherently evil. And if you know how to work with them, if you know how to talk to them, if you can negotiate properly and show the right respect, kobolds can be actually great allies. And I've played that into my games pretty consistently for the last few years. I really like kobolds as a race that everyone assumes is evil, but they turn out not to be. Orcs, I've done some similar stuff, especially I had one campaign, the City of Ulok, where the orcs that I designed for them were actually all lawful neutral for the most part. That they were just, I mean, yes, kind of big, strong. People assumed that they were brutish and violent, but in reality, just a bunch of hard workers. And they're not good, not evil. They do their work and then they go home, and they're great for you know, your manual labor and your hauling and your gardening and they were getting a lot of business doing that. And interestingly, doing all of this under the direction, the leadership behind the scenes of a pure evil ogre lich. But despite the fact that he was himself evil, he had actually fostered a society that went out and in serving him, in making themselves part of the greater community, weren't evil. And I like that. I like that a lot about orcs. I like having some nuance to them. So what it comes down to me is, yes, you can have races that are often evil or more often evil, but it's usually for good cultural reasons. And it's a tough one because, I mean, again, you're playing a only pseudo historical fantasy game here. That's one of the big problems is that, I mean, if you look at real human society, every society are arguably up to the present day, but let's just say, you know, starting 200 years ago and back, every human society through all of history up until a couple hundred years ago, every human society has been evil by modern standards. Every human society has been evil by D&D standards. Just all of them. Because slavery has been a given for almost all of human history in almost every society we've got. Slavery is a given. In warfare, even up through World War II, and arguably beyond that, but even up through World War II, following a huge battle, rape, pillage, plunder was just the name of the game. That's just what happened after. I mean, when you go in and you have now, you know, the city's been under siege and the soldiers all finally storm in and we take the city for ourselves. One of the things that happens is those soldiers loot the city. They steal everything. They rape the women. They kill indiscriminately. They horrible, horrible things happen in war. And that's always just been an accepted part of war forever. So it's hard to, you know, it's hard to say that, you know, so if we have orcs that are acting exactly the way humans have always acted, well, that makes them inherently evil. It's tough. That why, I don't know. Some people get enlightened in these games and some people don't. But here's where the discussions got a little too far for me, is that they're talking about, how, yes, you know what, we need to stop making all these races inherently evil. We need to, you know, examine the cultural underpinnings that go along with orcs or hobgoblins or ogres or whoever else, even elves and dwarves, that dark elves, that, you know, they point out that dark elves have always been inherently evil until, you know, Drizzt came along and suddenly there's this hero worship and this sympathy for the race. And now we've really delved into dark elves, over the last few years to make them into something much deeper than just, oh, look, black elves from underground and they're always evil. And the same sort of thing has been happening for orcs and for some of the other races. And so they're talking about how, you know, it would be valuable if instead of just labeling stuff as evil because that's just the way it is, why don't we look at why they're evil? Let's look at it. And I'm like, okay, I'm going along with this. This works for me. Until someone carries that to the next logical step and says, and not ironically in any way whatsoever, someone says, well, you know, even when you travel to the abyss or hell and you look at the demons, and once you get to examine their culture, there may be some really good, whoa, no, back the truck up on that one. This is where, again, I hit a wall, is because part of the design of Pathfinder and D&D, for good or bad, is that there is such a thing as inherent evil. And it doesn't necessarily mean that these, you know, mortal races that walk the earth have to be inherently evil, but that's the whole point of the Outer Planes, is that, you know, there is a source of good and evil, law and chaos, fire, water, positive and negative energy. It's all, these are primal planes whose energy feed into our own and whose denizens will be reflective of that natural state. And so when we're talking about demons or devils, no, demons and devils by definition are defined by being evil. They are powered by evil. The idea that I'm going to go into the abyss and try and work out the cultural underpinnings of the abyss to make them understandable and sympathetic as a group. Nah, you know what? In my games, maybe that's good for you, but in my games, nope, demons are going to be always evil. That's just the way it goes. And yes, there's always that rare story where you're going to get the demon who's been redeemed, just like you're going to have angels and divas and other things who have fallen for whatever reason. But those are the rare exceptions. In general, demons, devils, powered by evil. They're evil. And you know what? When you run across demons and devils, killing them is still, in my games, a pretty safe bet. I mean, you gotta know that they're evil. You gotta know that they're up to no good. You've gotta, but you know, hey, maybe I'm mistaken on that. I don't think so, though. So once the demons and devil thing kind of pushed me back from, because I was getting all sympathetic with this, and then someone went demons and devils, and I'm like, whoa, stop. Okay. We've gone too far into la la land here. Let's back it up. But then someone hit me where it hurts on this one and said the idea of having inherent evil, and they were speaking in the context of mortal races, not outsiders. But having inherent evil is just lazy writing. And I'm like, oh, you know what? There's the truth of it. It really is. Because labeling orcs or dark elves or hobgoblins or whoever as just, well, they're evil just because that's the way they are. That's the way they were designed. And then leaving it at that. That is lazy writing. That's just we need some easy villains. When you jump into this game, you need to know that these are the people you can fight. We need to get right into the action. And rather than having to explain to you how the world works and who these people are, you know what? We'll just tell you that, nah, it's orcs. Orcs are evil. Nah, it's all right. Go ahead. Kill them. We're good. Yeah, that's lazy. That's lazy. I need to be better than that as a dungeon master, as a gamer. I need to be bigger than that. So, all right. Let me cover my notes. Have I covered everything? Historical racism, gender equality. I'm not going to go much into the gender equality. I mean, yeah, look, again, Pathfinder has gone way out of its way to make things more equal, egalitarian when it comes to gender. You'll notice that half the characters presented are female. Females take on these strong, positive roles in adventuring on equal footing with males. Which again, still speaks to the fact that we're not playing a historical fantasy. We're playing a pseudo-historical fantasy. We're playing our modern sensibilities surrounded by these historical trappings. Because again, if we were playing real history, or a more realistic historical fantasy, everybody's evil back then. All societies are evil. You want to try and be good, but even the good people still have a really tough time. I mean, all right, here's a good example. Look at Game of Thrones. Read Game of Thrones. There's a lot of people in Game of Thrones who are noble in their way, and there's a lot of people that, you know, you want to support, but Game of Thrones is a harsh world where even the people that we root for the most sometimes have to do some really, really nasty crap, okay? And it's also a world where sexism and racism are very, very real, which is not to say that he's a sexist author, although some people can argue that he is, and I get that. But in general, he has lots of very, very strong female characters. They are just, in general, the majority of his female characters are not warriors, because that was not the role of women in that sort of society, and the societies that he bases those books on. The role of women was not typically that of warrior. There are some women warriors, but they're exceptions, not the rule. Whereas men, most of the men, carry a weapon and know how to use it. That's just how it balances out. And again, what it shows for me is that you can have a game where you have lots of racism and lots of sexism. But again, if you're not taking the lazy way out with your writing, you can have lots of evil. You can have all of that, but you can do it in a cultural context, not saying that we are evil for creating this world, that we're bad people, sexist, racist, whatever, for creating this world, but rather that we are role-playing in a world that has those elements. And if done right, can even highlight those elements to show in contrast to our modern day, or how we would like to ideally see our modern world. I don't know what point I'm making. I lost my words on that one. Doesn't make any difference. Anyway, do I have a bigger point? Oh yeah, I do. My bigger point, orcish hair. This is what I wanted to get to. all of this talk about evil and racism, this just builds up to hairstyles. This is just a sidebar that all of this that I've been thinking about with race and gender and evil and culture, all of this, in the center of it has always been this little knot of orcish hair. Because orcs, and it, actually, when you think about it, while they want, you know, this article as an example, and a lot of people want to make the comparison that orcs represent some sort of racist idea against black people or other non-white people, in reality, as other people have pointed out, orcs really, more than anything, represent the stereotype of Viking culture. I mean, honest to God, these big, burly, brutish savages that come charging at you with these giant axes and why Viking barbarians? Because that's who the Romans were scared of. All right. If you want to look back at historical fantasy, that was the big enemy throughout most of Roman history and then medieval history. Were we ever worried about the non-white Africans charging up from the southern continent at us with their huge weapons and destroying our cities and taking our women? No, it was the Huns. It was the Mongols. It was the Vikings. It was these barbarian, okay, granted, Mongols are non-whites. I get that. But you get my point. They're still, especially the Viking culture. And so as I'm looking at this idea that the orcs represent, this stereotype of Viking culture, as people of that, of history may have feared them and stereotyped them. One of the things I just read about earlier, and I don't know how much validity there is to it, but the idea that barbarians, Vikings, were not these dirty, unkempt savages that everyone makes them out to be. And I've done enough studying of Viking culture to realize that, they were civilized in their own way. They were more on the chaotic side of the spectrum than lawful, if you're looking in D&D terms. Clearly, they were bigger on individuality and individual success and heroism and that sort of stuff, proving yourself on the battlefield, that kind of stuff. But not savages by any stretch. And this article pointed out, and again, I hope it's true, and from what I know of them, I think it is the idea that Vikings, northern barbarians in general, they actually had, some of them had a lot of focus on grooming and styling their hair and their beards and their mustaches. This whole idea that, you know, if you wanted to prepare for battle or if you wanted to prepare for some proper formal event or whatever, no, styling your hair and beard, the dudes would go way out with the waxes and the combs and the brushing and the teasing and getting just the right look. And so to me, this, as I'm looking at my new avatar from my own character with her braids and everything, I thought, oh my God, what if I did that for orcs? What if I did that for orc men? Oh my God, the orcs, despite their image as these brutal savages, What if orcs really are just cultivating that appearance? I mean, they're still, you know, brutal. It's still a rough society. I'm not going to take any of that away from them necessarily. But imagine how much different they feel in a game if you find out that behind the scenes, they put a lot of primping into their battle readiness. That part of going into battle is you have to look the part. You have to be as ferocious as possible. Whether it's, you know, doing the Celtic style war paint, you know, or the huge Viking beards or the hairstyles, the whatever you need to do to get yourself looking as ferocious as humanly possible before you go charging into the battle. Cause you want to look as unreal, as otherworldly as possible, just to scare your enemy, to cow them into submission. And that's just part of their culture, is doing this huge threat display before they go out anywhere. And I'm like, oh, hairstyling orcs, that really, really appeals to me. I'm going to find a way to work that in. I haven't quite gotten a grasp on it yet, but it's getting close. I really like these guys. And oh my God, that's another half hour I've spent on Pathfinder. Oh, this is going to be a theme, I think, for this show. So you know what? Let's get done with that one. And do I have time? No, I had a nerd rage, but I am going to have to wait for that nerd rage until next week. And I think it's one I've done before. It's just kind of grating on my nerves. You know what? I'll do it quick. Oh, no. Get the little ones out of the room. Make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back. And I just looked at him and went, Rrr!
That's right. It's time for some nerd rage. Get off your phones. Get off your phones. What is wrong with you? Do you not know how to have a civilized conversation? What? All right, let me tell you something. If I am speaking to you, look me in the eye. All right? Or at least, if you can't look me in the eye, at least look like you're paying attention. But for God's sake, if you pull out your phone without saying anything, without acknowledging the interruption, if you pull out your phone and even glance at it while I'm in the middle of speaking, you have just disrespected me to a level that clearly you do not understand. That is so freaking rude. What is wrong with you? Oh, and again, I know it's a generational thing. I know it's a generational thing for the large part. And I think I've brought this up in the Nerd Rage before, probably 30 episodes ago, but I had a new manager at my office. This guy was, and he's young, like young to me, like 30-ish, all right, maybe a little bit younger than that. But he's a manager, and he shows up, and for the first week that I knew him, he could not have a conversation without constantly glancing at his phone while you're having a conversation with him. And it freaked me the hell out. I hated it. I knew it was just because he was young and this was his first, even though he's the manager, this is really his first big professional job. I get that. And sure enough, you know, by a year later, and he's finally moved on to other things. This has been a couple of years now. But by a year later, you could see he had learned. Like all through this year, every time I ran across him, he was a little bit better about it until finally, by the end, he would never, never dream of looking at his phone while he was in the middle of talking to somebody. All right. And he learned. He got there. Jesus, people, learn this lesson. You just, and I don't have a problem. If you need to take a call or if you need to look at a message, you know, you feel your phone vibrate while you're talking to me, great. Just, acknowledge it. Say, oh, hold on, just 2 seconds. And then you look at the phone, and then you put it back in your pocket, and you go, sorry about that, and then we carry on with our conversation. But the idea that you're just going to look at your phone, like, I don't believe in multitasking, okay? That's another thing. For all you people out there who talk about how great you are at multitasking, you're all liars, every one of you, all right? Nobody's good at multitasking. Well, you can be good at multitasking, but you know what's even better than multitasking? You know what science tells us is better than multitasking? Doing one thing at a time. All right. You can have two tasks that you need to get done. And if you do one and then do the other, you will do them both better, more efficiently, faster than if you try and do them both at the same time, no matter who you are. All right. Unless, granted, there may be a race of octopus people out here who don't have an actual brain and instead just have a diffuse neural net, with a bunch of nodes in it. And you guys, more than happy to let you go multitask, because I'm sure the way your neural net works, you're more than capable of concentrating on more than one thing at a time, because you don't have to have a central brain store to divide all that stuff up. Great for you octopus people. For the rest of us, stop it. All right. So when you're looking at your phone, your attention is away from me. And I know you're still kind of listening to me, but you're also reading this text. And therefore, once your attention's not on me anymore, I'm just going to stop talking. And then you're going to think, oh, I'm sorry. Am I being, and then you're going to kind of resent me for pointing that out to you. But trust me, you'll thank me for it later. Get off your phone. Okay. That's enough of that. Now it is time for, oh, that's right. We don't have a badass movie quote of the week. In fact, see, it's been retired. I don't even have to do the voice anymore. Badass movie quote of the week. I still have to do the voice, but we don't have one. Instead, we're going straight into the Pod-O-Matic. Yeah. Holy blueberries. This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 in his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that is where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Send your question or your topic to me by email, or better yet, send it to me in a private message on my forums. I will add it to this Pod-O-Matic list I have right here in front of me, because Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. And R2 has given me A92, which is from Zimnipot. What's your favorite talking animal? My favorite talking animal would be, it's not Mr. Ed, certainly not Francis the Talking Mule. A part of me wants to say Bun Bun from Sluggy Freelance, but that's just because I just got caught up on Sluggy Freelance yesterday. And so Bun Bun, I'm not going to give any spoilers. If you haven't read Sluggy Freelance online comic, go out and read it. There's only 15 years worth of material out there. It's a daily comic, so it'll only take you a few weeks to get caught up. But I like Bun Bun a lot. I know he's kind of cliche, kind of Mary Sue-ish in his way. And yet, for some reason, I'm really fond of him. He had one of the most confusing stories that Sluggy Freelance did was Ocean's Unmoving, which I hated Ocean's Unmoving when I first read it. That's why I stopped reading Sluggy for a long time, because Sluggy is a comic that's really hard to follow at times. And Ocean's Unmoving just was not doing it for me. And then later I decided, you know what, I think I'm going to get back. I think I'm going to try getting back to Sluggy again. And so I started over at the beginning of Ocean's Unmoving. And once I read the whole thing as a single unit, oh, it all made sense. And it was a really good story. Probably my favorite. I think I've read Ocean's Unmoving probably 3 times now, because I really like that story. And it gives you glimpses of Bun Bun's origins without really getting at the heart of the matter. It gives you so much teaser information and I think that's why I like him so much. I'm sure Bun Bun is not my favorite talking animal, because there are so many of them out there. I mean, do Pokemon, are they classified as animals? I mean, not that I think that any Pokemon would necessarily be my favorite, but I'm just saying there's a lot of talking animals out there. It's going to have to be Garfield. I got to go with Garfield, right? No, I'm kidding. I can't even leave that joke. I'm sitting here like, I'm going to just get ended on Garfield. I'll just do Garfield, and then R2 will click, and then they'll just be stuck with that one. I couldn't even do it. I'm just going to go with Bun Bun for now. I'm sure there's others. Lots of others that I'm sure Bun Bun only ranks 10th or 11th, but he's the one I'm going to do for now. Whoa! Number 11, Mr. I say Mr., but there could always be a woman in here. I don't know for sure. I know Lucy has submitted some questions. Nope, but it's not Lucy. It's Stan. Stan says, do you have a favorite type or flavor of tea? Nope. If I have to drink tea, I won't. No, you know what? I was going to name off whatever tea I would drink if I drank tea, but I don't like tea. I would rather have coffee. That's just the way it is. And you know why? Because I'm an American, damn it. That's just the way it goes. Number 90. All right, back to the other end of the list. This one's from Billy Bob. Billy Bob says, how do you feel about long walks on the beach? Oh, are you coming on to me? Oh, that's awesome. I like long walks on the beach. I've always liked long walks on the beach. We've always done that. Since I was a kid, it was just one of the things you would do because we went to the beach all the flipping time when I was little. Down in Florida, a little place called Mexico City Beach, which is about an hour down from Panama, where Panama City is where Spring Break used to be on MTV. I don't know if it still is. But beautiful white sand beach down there. And not overrun and touristy like Panama City. My grandparents had a beach house down there, and then later had two beach houses down there, and it was just a great place to go hang out. And one of the things that you'd do is, in the evenings especially, you know, after you spent the whole day swimming and building sandcastles and burying people in the sand and finding shells and crabs and whatever else, at night, you just go out and go walk the beach. Just walk on down, and sometimes during the day, but you just go down and walk all the way down to the pier, which the pier was only like a half mile, quarter, or three-quarter mile down the beach. It wasn't far. Or we'd go to the other pier, which was like 2 miles in the other direction. But always loved doing that, because you walk in and out of the surf, and you watch how your footprints go, or sometimes you just stand there and let the waves wash over you so your feet sink down in the sand. I love long walks on the beach. I could do that all the time. Number 66, Zimney Pot. Zimney says, what common fantasy trope would you like to... This is going to be a tough question already, I can tell. What common fantasy trope would you like to see a sci-fi version of? The first question is there any common fantasy trope that we don't already have a sci-fi version of? I mean, really? Is there anything? I mean, what kind of fantasy tropes are we talking about? Are we talking about dragons? Because there's sci-fi versions of dragons. There's, you know, hell, Shadowrun covers moving most of those fantasy elements into a sci-fi setting. The story arc is the same if you're going to be, you know, the chosen one who has to rise up from obscurity and fulfill your destiny and defeat the Dark One, you know, go through your traditional mythical, story arc. That's been done in sci-fi and fantasy. I mean, hell, Star Wars takes the typical fantasy setting, even right down to the magic and the swords, and makes it all sci-fi. This is a tough one. If you can come up with a fantasy trope that hasn't been made sci-fi, I mean, all right, just the other day I was thinking, this ties in, I think, because someone on another podcast was mentioning something about genetically engineered dinosaurs they're genetically engineered using your own DNA so that they are mentally bonded to you from birth, so that you basically have a pet dinosaur who is psychically linked to you and ultimately completely loyal to you. And I was thinking about that in terms of, like the Paladin's Mount from D&D, the fantasy trope of having this animal that you form this lifelong bond with, this mystical bond that makes them your lifelong companion, you know, and that the two of you are completely intertwined. And I'm like, well, that's been done in sci-fi in plenty of ways. I mean, just the one example he gave with the dinosaur thing, which I have no idea what story or game or book that came from, but I mean, he described it often. It's the same kind of concept. Or Dragon Riders of Pern, which opens up looking like a fantasy setting, but it turns out it's actually a sci-fi setting, and it involves telepathy and bonding with your dragons when they hatch, and, you know, having this mystical bond to your mount, throughout, or even, Cameron's avatar, with, you know, having your little, you know, he had to, you know, find and master that flying pterodactyl dragon, whatever that thing was. And, you know, he hooks his little psychic braid tail nerve center up to it. And they have this bond, and they mesh, they meld. You know, it's the same sort of thing. So I don't know, Zim. I don't know. I can't think of any fantasy tropes that aren't already sci-fi somewhere. I mean, people have been doing this for a long time. If you guys can come up with some examples for me, I will listen. I just can't think of any myself. I'm not that creative. Number 87. This is Zimny again. Zim says, how big should Godzilla actually be? That is a good question, Zim. In my opinion, well, maybe not so much anymore. Because Godzilla was, I don't know how tall Godzilla was in the original movies, but I had a sci-fi comparison or sci-fi fantasy comparison chart that used to be over my bulletin board in my office. And it would list all the sizes of various items all the way down from people all the way up through the largest sci-fi items ever. And one of the interesting things about this list of size comparisons is they had original Godzilla on it, and then they had the Matthew Broderick Godzilla movie Godzilla on it. And the Matthew Broderick Godzilla was roughly twice as tall as the original Godzilla. And I think the size that Godzilla needs to be is whatever makes him look just impressive enough against the skyscrapers that he's facing. Because in the original Godzilla movie, this was the short Godzilla version, but Godzilla was just tall enough to kind of, his head was just over the tops, maybe not quite at the tops of the skyscrapers around him. All right. But then you get to the next, Godzilla, the Matthew Broderick Godzilla. I don't even remember what year that was. 2000? I have no idea. But you get to, that Godzilla, and he is way taller. All right, because if you look at that Godzilla, most of the time, she is just at the tops of most of the skyscrapers, although there's a few buildings that dwarf her, so she still has the ability to hide behind a lot of the tallest structures, or be obscured by, not necessarily hide behind, because Godzilla's not in the business of hiding, but she could be obscured by some of the tallest buildings, but most of the buildings of New York, she can just see over, and it's almost as if they scaled the height for that exact reason, I would think. I don't know. I think too big, well, what's too big when you're talking about Godzilla? I was just about to say, when you get too big like that, I think it starts to get a little bit silly. I know there's another Godzilla coming out, and I haven't even looked, but I imagine that this Godzilla will be even bigger than the last one. That's just the nature of the beast, is that if you're going to do another Godzilla movie, well, it's got to be bigger and better, right? So I don't know for sure. I would like to say that I would think the right size for a Godzilla. Oh no, I know exactly how tall. 30 stories high. That's how tall. You know why? Up from the depths, 30 stories high, breathing fire, head in the sky, Godzilla, Godzilla, and Godzuki. Yeah. See, I wasn't going to sing the whole song because I was embarrassing myself. I realized I couldn't quit until I got to Godzuki, right? That was the whole point of that one. This is the number 20. I'm such an ass laughing at myself. That's dumb. This is from Kyle. Kyle says, here's a titillating question. What's the best D&D nudity other than the succubus? That is a rough question, because clearly if you were going to ask me what the best D&D nudity is, immediately, succubus, first edition AD&D Monster Manual succubus, hands down. Okay. Other than that, oh man, that is so tough. There have been, a number, and I get so mixed up though between third edition 3.5 Pathfinder, the online versions I'm looking at, that I know that there has been at least one nymph that was just over the top awesome. And it was, I think it was in Pathfinder. Really good one. But I can't even remember if it was straight up nudity or if it was just implied nudity. But I remember wanting to make a nymph that had been corrupted by demon influence, the big bad guy. And so we were looking this up and she had this charisma score of like 30 something. And it was just, and the picture that went with it was just stunning and perfect. Also, and this one's terrible. I hate to even bring it up, but in the Book of Vile Darkness, was that the ultimate evil book from D&D 3.5? The Book of Vile Darkness has a list of, the devil lords in it. And one of the devil lords, and I think it may be level 3 Mammon. I'd have to look it up and I'm not going to do that. But it shows him and his daughter, who are co-rulers of whatever plane this is. And the picture in the Book of Vile Darkness is the two of them, and even though it's father-daughter, the book makes it very clear that there is an incestuous relationship between the two of them. So that makes this whole thing really disgusting, and yet the picture of her is just really hot. Really good picture. That is terrible. But I can't... All right, if I have to give a definitive answer to this question, for now, I'm going to have to say nymph, but I don't remember if it was nudity, so I don't know if it qualifies. I can't even name which one. From the original first edition, that one should be easier to come up with. The original first edition, it was all about demons and devils. Back then, the succubus was one, and then they had, what are the six-armed devil ladies, the ones that do the, they're like devil generals, maybe demon generals. Oh, I can't remember. But there was a six-armed demon lady that had some bare breasts going on, and that was not bad in that book either. Nothing compared to the succubus, but you get the point. All right, I'm done with this one. Oh, thank you. Okay, this is number 65 is from Kyle. Kyle says, what is your best impression, and can you then do that person singing Love Shack by the B-52s? My best impression is, I don't know. I can do, here's the problem I have. The impressions that I can do, I can't do impressions. I can do imitations, all right? So if you need me to do, like, one of the ones I can do is Squeeze, the band Squeeze. One of their songs is Cool for Cats. And in Cool for Cats, he sings with a very heavy accent in that one. And I can do that accent if I'm doing just a straight-up imitation of the song. So am I obligated to do that now? I already embarrassed myself with the Godzilla song. I think I'm done with singing. All right. The Indians send signals from the rocks above the pass. The cowboys take position in the bushes and the grass. The score is with the corporal. She is tied against a tree. Doesn't mind the language. It's a beating she don't need. Let's see that kind of thing. And that's not even a very good one, but I'm doing a straight up impression of exactly what they say on the album. If I need to go outside of that, I'm not very good at it. I've tried. I can do, if I listen to, the Fofop podcast with Will Anderson, if I listen to several episodes in a row or several episodes in just a couple of days, I can do not an Australian accent necessarily, but I can do a good imitation of Will Anderson himself and his Australian accent. I can't do a generalized Australian accent, but I can do just him. And his is almost an LA, Los Angeles affected sort of Australian accent because he spends a lot of time in LA. So he does a little, and Australians do it too, but you get that lilting kind of lift on the end of every sentence, sort of inflection to it. I guess if I'm going to sing, I could, if I'm going to have to sing something as an impression, my brother, when we were in college, pointed out that any song became funnier if you sang it as Bob Dylan. And I can't actually sing as Bob Dylan, but I can sing as a horrible, horrible stereotype of Bob Dylan's voice. And his original example was R.E.M.'s Losing My Religion. And his impression of this was way better than mine. But he would do, "That's me in the corner. That's me in the spot. Light, lose it." And it was really funny. All right. And see, I'm so embarrassed that I cut myself off before you guys even got the full flavor of that. Could I do that to Love Shack by the B-52s? "Love Shack, baby. Love Shack. That's where it's at. Love Shack. That's where it's at." I could do a really bad Bob Dylan impression to Love Shack. That's not bad. Which this is one that actually doing Bob Dylan singing anything. Take any popular song that your kids like and then sing it with that really overly done Bob Dylan voice makes them laugh every time. So my kids know that. And every once in a while, they'll even come up with, as we're singing along to a song, they'll go, "Ooh, do it as Bob Dylan. Do it as Bob Dylan." And then I'll do a really, really crappy Bob Dylan impression. But God, why are all these questions embarrassing me? I'm moving on again. Thank you. 29. Talvin. "What is your favorite polyhedral dice shape?" Ooh, that's a good one. Because obviously the die 12 is my favorite die. But which one's my favorite shape? Alright. I like the die 8 for shape. And part of it is that the 8, and I don't know if this is going to make any sense to you, the 8 and the 6 are a reversal of one another. All right. And this is, if you take a six-sided die has 8 corners with 6 sides. All right. Well, if you flatten those out and change every side to a corner and every corner to a side, you wind up with the die 8 because the die 8 has only 6 corners and 8 sides. And I find that fascinating. I don't know why. And so there's something about the die 8 that I first discovered that property of it, that it was this, Maybe not reversal is the right word, but this translation of the die 6, another form, the same concept, same structure sort of as a die 6, but reformed. And I like that. And I also like that the die 8 is 2 square pyramids pressed together. And you can look at it from, 3 different angles and you still get that same square pyramid effect. Whereas you do a die 10 is a pentagonal pyramid, sort of, except the way the sides interlock is a little bit different. But the die 10 does, the 5 on one side, 5 on the other. And you could even do a die 12 that way, or a die 14, or a die 16. You can do any even number of sides and just have a pyramid of one set of sides on over here and the other pyramid over here, and they just interlock that way. And you could make them roll. And I find that fascinating, and I like, of those, the 2 facing pyramids like that structure, which in real dice you only see in the die 10 and the die 8, but it could be extrapolated out. I like it best on the die 8 because it's simple. I suppose you could also do a die 6 that way, that you could do a die 6 that, well, no, because if you did a die 6, would it roll properly? Could you do an interlocking pyramid with a die 6? No, because then when it landed, you'd have an edge facing up. If I got it correctly in my mind. Yeah, you would have, if it landed flat on the face, then the top part would just be a straight edge. There would be no actual, so you'd have 2 facing sides. That doesn't work. So you couldn't do a die 6 that way. So maybe not all of them work. Maybe just die 8 and die 10. Now, there's got to be others that do work that way, but I can't. The math is too much for me. Oh, great noise. Number 15 from Zimny. Would you rather be able to speak any language fluently or be able to speak to animals? Whoa, 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 whoa. When you say any language, you mean I'm a polyglot who can speak literally any language on earth or speak to animals? Screw that. I'm speaking any language. I would love to be able to speak any language other than English fluently. I would love to be able to speak Spanish or French or German or sign language. Sign language would obviously be my first choice. I've said that before. I would love to have the ability to speak another language, much less any and all languages. I would take the ability to speak Spanish fluently over the ability to talk to animals. I would do that. Or Latin or Japanese. I don't care. I would love. Although, I mean, talking to animals would be cool, but, you gotta go back to the old Far Side cartoon of the scientist who puts on his helmet so he knows what dogs are thinking. And what all dogs are thinking is, hey, 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 hey. That's pretty much it. That's it. When dogs are talking, that's all they want. So, yeah, would it be cool to talk to dolphins and chimps and maybe some of these other animals, or an octopus, some of these animals who, for all we know, may have higher thought processes? That would be kind of cool. But I would just love to be able to speak another language. All right, this one is, also from Zimny. Zimny, 27, sorry. Would you rather be a witch or a ghost? Witch, because if I'm a witch, I'm still alive and I have magic powers. I don't want to be no ghost. Seriously. Have you seen the movie Ghost? That was miserable. No, no good. Hey, and that brings us to the very end of this podcast. I want to do some credits, but first, we need a recap.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week is Weezer's In the Garage, and She Blinded Me by Science, Blinded Me with Science as performed by William Shatner. I have this goal that one day I'll get through this flawlessly. All these songs are available on iTunes. Check them out. Buy them. Enjoy them. Love them. I wouldn't put them in my podcast if I didn't love them myself. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes and write me a nice review. Or check out my Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. Stop at the Facebook page. Click the like button. It's just 9 seconds out of your day. You can do that for a buddy. Don't forget to check out the free games I have available on my free games page. Instant Game, Animal Ball Melee, Sandbox Hill, and 2/3 of a dozen others. Confirmed that number, by the way. All free, all the time. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com, and I promise I will actually respond to you. But to be totally honest, the very best way to talk to me is to come and sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. You sign up there, you send me a private message, we'll hang out together, we will have fun. Number 54. This one's from Kyle. Are you and Yancey close enough coworkers to audibly fart around each other? What about you and Joel? Me and Yancey, yes. Me and Joel, no. Joel is just not a farter, I don't think. I'm pretty sure he's never farted in his life. Yancey, on the other hand, I'm convinced pretty much is farting 24/7. That's just the kind of guy he is. Yancey and I are not the kind where we are intentionally and loudly farting around each other all the time. That just, it's not that kind of guy relationship. But if one of us were to fart, the other one would not be offended or particularly bothered by it anyway. It happens. You know, no one cares.